Hello, I'm Ross Camage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today, normally I have to reach out to guests to get them, but my guest today actually reached out to me, and you'll see there's a particular reason for this. My guest today is Dr. Karen Reckamp. Karen, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Well, thank you for having me, Ross. And so I guess in my professional world, I'm a thoracic medical oncologist and the division director of medical oncology and associate director for clinical research at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. And on the personal side, I'm a mother of a 17-year-old, a wife, and a friend and a cousin and a middle child and a Midwesterner at heart. But I think when I think about this and thinking about introducing myself, I think about the things that I am kind of at a cellular level, maybe. And, you know, I would say that the role of wife and mother are true to my core. But I would also say that my role as a physician is also pretty close to the heart. But more recently, something that's come up is I've become a caregiver for a cancer patient who happens to be my husband. And that is something that becomes really close to you really quickly, and whether you've chosen it or not.
Yeah. And I'm glad you framed it that way, because I think sometimes the caregivers, that just becomes the label and the person behind it sort of disappears. So I know we're going to end up there, but I want to dig a little bit into Karen Reckamp as a person. So where did Karen, where was she born and brought up?
So I grew up outside of the suburbs of Chicago in a town called Arlington Heights. And my mother was a school teacher, then stayed at home with four children. And my father was a mason and worked on sites, but was a bricklayer and took a lot of pride in that work that he did. And they had four kids that they raised, four kids in 5 years. So I say that at some points in my mother's life, she was not necessarily thinking straight. But we all made it through, and all four of us went to college, which I think was a huge goal of my parents. And I'm the only physician in my family, and I'm number three of four in that mix of chaos of children that we had.
Were they brothers or sisters?
I have two brothers and one sister.
What, a younger sister and then two older brothers?
I have an older sister, an older brother, and a younger brother.
And then, so you guys are first generation university.
My mother actually did go to university to be a teacher, but she came from Amsterdam after World War II, and found her way through and kind of muddled through night school and things like that. So didn't have a university experience in the same way that we did. And my dad, he went straight from the military to working on construction sites and having, you know, going through an apprenticeship and becoming a mason. And so in many ways we were all first generation college students.
So why medicine?
So I have a strong connection to medicine and oncology since early in my life. On my dad's side, there is BRCA, and he came from a large family of 13 children. And my mother's best friend, who was also my father's sister, was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in her 30s. And it was an imprinting time of my life, though I might not have recognized it at the time, but it was clearly meaningful for my mother. And my aunt was in our presence a lot during that time. And ovarian cancer in the 80s was not a disease that was all that treatable. And it still is kind of etched in my mind what she went through. And then before my end of high school, my dad's second sister was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and died of ovarian cancer. And I had no choice but to go down the path of medicine and oncology at some point.
Well, you could have gone either way. I mean, you could have said that was a horrible experience. I want to run away from that. So do you remember what you felt at the time?
So probably a lot of my motivation came from a protection of my mother, which I think a lot of the things that we do come from trying to protect our mothers or find the love of our mothers. And, you know, when my aunt died, that was her very good friend, it forever changed her and our household. And this is more retrospective that I can look back and see all of that. And so I think there was a part of me, I'd always been interested in science and that direction. But for a very long time, I felt a draw toward taking care of people and becoming a physician. And then when I was in medical school, oncology really just spoke to me in a way that there was really no question that that was the direction that I wanted to go.
So where did you go to college? What did you major in initially before you went to medical school?
So I was at University of Illinois in Champaign, Urbana, and I majored in molecular and cellular biology, which in those days was a very new major. That was you know, just the up and coming major, and I knew that I wanted to go to medical school. That was pretty clear. And I was really on a path to get there. And so I actually graduated in 3 years to move on to where I really thought I needed to be rather than sticking around in the undergrad years.
And so imagine that I'm just a simple foreigner. So you can just push the accelerate button and get through. I'm going to do it in 3 years.
Yeah. So I guess the U.S. and the U.K. a little bit different in how they do things. But we have, I think the systems are highly different now, but we took AP tests and things like that that could give you college credit for things that were like calculus and chemistry and things like that. And so I had enough classes that I had taken in high school that were acceptable, that they got me enough credits to move on for an extra year. So I was able to take a summer school class and then graduate in 3 years.
And then where was your medical school?
So then I moved to University of Chicago, which was somewhat of a novel thing from a family that didn't spend a lot of time thinking about higher education other than that we needed it. And I think some of my mentors in college and advisors who kind of pushed me in a direction of going toward a more academic career, because I'm not sure that I even knew what that meant when I was an undergrad.
And then why university? I mean, is it just like, were you going back at the weekends to home? I mean, Illinois and Chicago, I mean, you don't like traveling?
I think when I was first leaving high school, I'm not sure. I looked at University of Rochester in New York, you know, in the middle of nowhere in New York. But
just to apologize to everyone for my
It's a beautiful place. It was a lovely experience. But I wasn't ready as a person to make that jump, to make that leap, because, you know, University of Illinois is really a suburb of Chicago. When you look at it, it's, you know, most of the people are around you. And so I think I was somebody who needed to still be in my backyard while exploring this bigger world of education and academics and things that really weren't a huge part of my family before I started to explore it. And so I think going to University of Chicago was a commitment to wanting to be academic and what that meant to be at University of Chicago, but also needing to be a little bit closer to home and still finding myself in many ways at that time in my life.
And then you go through medical school and I think you said that you knew you wanted to do oncology as you were going through. Did you flirt with anything else or was it always oncology?
I think the closest I got to, actually, which is a little ironic, it was orthopedics, in part because of the mentorship that I had. And we had an attending who was really out on the edge trying to get more women into orthopedics. I think that was like his goal was to get women into orthopedics. So when he found people who had interest and were doing well, he started to kind of pluck us and try to pull us in that direction. So for a little while, I thought maybe I could do orthopedic surgery. And then I kind of found my true home in understanding that I preferred practicing the medicine rather than the more technical pieces of doing the surgeries.
And then did you do your oncology fellowship at the University of Chicago?
So then I, yeah, so I, when I was in Chicago living in Hyde Park, I think it was kind of the first time that I felt like an adult in the world and found my ways in the world. And living as an adult in Chicago has its drawbacks. You know, living as a kid where you have a snow day when you get 10 inches of snow is just wonderful and fun, and you build forts and you don't really worry about how cold and miserable it is. When you're on your surgical rotation and you have to get in by 4:30 in the morning and you have to shovel your car out and it's negative 15 degrees, winter becomes a whole nother experience.
Yeah.
And so at the end of medical school, I felt the need to find a warmer climate and experience something different than Chicago. And so staying in that region for as long as I did helped me to understand that I'd like to explore other areas. And I didn't go far. I went to WashU in St. Louis, which is within driving distance of Chicago, but a much more mild climate in comparison, and kind of was the start of my westward movement, if you will.
It's not that far west.
No. Well, but it is the gateway to the west, if you will.
Oh, very good. Great.
If you've seen the arch, that was the gateway to the west.
So what was your time like there? What was going on in your life?
In residency, I was married to my medical school sweetheart, and we did residency together. And I was very committed to doing oncology, and I had done a lot of oncology and BMT service time when I had the chance to do it. So I would say that even in that time, the most memorable rotations were especially the bone marrow transplant rotations, which are incredibly intense during our residency time. And we had a big bone marrow transplant ward at WashU and at Barnes Jewish Hospital. And so I was happy, and I knew what I wanted to do. I was very focused on knowing that I wanted to do oncology. And I also knew that I would like to go somewhere warmer yet.
Let me ask one question. So how old were you when you first got married?
25.
Okay. And what did your husband do? He was a physician as well?
He was a physician. We were in the same medical school and residency program, and he is doing allergy and immunology currently at UCSD.
Okay. So when you make a decision to go somewhere warm, so then there's two of you who have two careers. So how did you, or maybe you both went, hey, this is freezing cold, I don't want to do this. Was it easy to decide where you wanted to go to next?
So I think the next step was a little bit more challenging. And I will credit my first husband in probably getting me to Los Angeles. I don't know that Los Angeles would have been a place I would have chosen on my own, but it was a place where we could both have fellowships together. And so I remember actually looking at Colorado, too, because they had a very good allergy immunology program there, too. But so we ended up in Los Angeles in part because it was a place where we could go together. And I think I felt brave enough to do it because we were doing it together. And I'm pretty certain I would not be living the life I'm living with it without that motivation from having my first husband and where we needed to go together to get there, despite the fact that after we got there, it wasn't, it didn't last that long.
So where did you end up in Los Angeles?
So I ended up at UCLA and hoping still to do actually bone marrow transplant at the time, because I was really fascinated in immune biology and the graft versus host effect and all of that. And so I was actually really, really motivated to do bone marrow transplant.
This was your first faculty job?
Which was during fellowship when I chose to work actually with Steve Dubinet, who's a pulmonologist. But when I was looking at labs to work in during fellowship, I had been talking about my desire to do immune biology and ultimately BMT. And what was told to me is, you know, really, if you want to do immune biology, talk to these people, but BMT doesn't have the best research focus at this moment in time at UCLA. So I met with Steve Dubinet. He was doing pulmonary, and this is before EGFR was discovered. and I thought I would learn immunology and move on and have my career in BMT. I did not anticipate doing thoracic oncology other than learning immunology in his lab.
So what happened?
So I think that EGFR happened and living on the West Coast happened, meaning that those two things together became that we saw different lung cancer than most people in other parts of the country. And whereas lung cancer was, you know, still incredibly a difficult disease where people lived often months to a year, it started to become a disease that you could really intervene on and make a change with, and became infinitely more interesting when we had the genomic alterations. And so I think the science, you know, started to match some of my interests. And because I had been working with in a pulmonary lab, it made a lot of sense to shift toward lung cancer.
So you get to the end of your fellowship at UCLA, and now you have to find a faculty job. At this point in time, maybe you're thinking more thoracic than BMT at this point?
Yeah, I think that once we learned about EGFR, which was near the end of my fellowship, and I was working in this lab, and we were actually creating dendritic cells that were gene modified to express this secondary lymphoid chemokine, making kind of the tumor into a lymph node, if you will. And this is 20 years before immunotherapy, or 10 years before immunotherapy actually became what it is. So most people said, you know, immunotherapy does nothing in lung cancer, but it was a principle that was really interesting. And then on the side, we were looking at EGFR. And running clinical trials and preclinical studies, and you know, so the biology became very interesting, and it became kind of a natural succession to start writing grants in lung cancer. And I stayed on as faculty at UCLA and continued to kind of work on the studies that we had started during my fellowship.
Now, I said I was going to push on some uncomfortable areas. So you said your first marriage didn't last that long after you moved to California. So when did it become your first marriage as opposed to your marriage, if you see what I mean?
So I think, you know, once we moved to California and we had been in the same program, we had been in medical school, we'd been internal medicine residency, we were doing the same thing. And then we got to California and I was doing oncology and my life was, you know, 24/7 many days, really intense. And he was doing allergy immunology, which amongst our friend group, we called it happy medicine. And really we did. And so there was kind of this world of I was living in this Dante's Inferno, yeah, and he was living in this happy place. And somehow we kind of lost each other in that, and life was happening, and he was a Midwesterner, we were both Midwesterners, we were in this totally different environment, now doing completely different things, developing different friendships and worlds, and kind of, I think, growing apart in a lot of ways.
Were you still in your fellowship or in your faculty when the divorce happened?
It was at the end of fellowship.
That's, you just pile that on in terms of all
exactly
stressors.
Major life changes, major stressors.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So you said you stayed on as faculty at UCLA, but you didn't stay there very long.
So I stayed on and I actually was doing a VA merit grant. And so those are 3 years for a career development award. And so I stayed on to kind of finish up some projects, and I had a part-time position at the VA and part-time at the main campus at UCLA. And then I think that, you know, when you're a junior faculty in a place, it's hard to differentiate yourself from your mentors and make a name other than that's the person who works really hard and does things under this person, right? Yeah. And so I think I became interested in trying to find another path, to find my own kind of voice in oncology. And so they were starting to expand on solid tumor oncology at City of Hope across the way in Los Angeles. And so it was something that, City of Hope had always been known for their bone marrow transplant and their heme malignancies, and they were expanding in solid tumors. And so I took the opportunity to lead thoracic at City of Hope. And that was really my breakaway to kind of find my own path in my career.
And then for those of us who are not Californians, so City of Hope is an academic institution. It's a private institution. What is it?
It is a freestanding cancer center that is east of Los Angeles, on kind of the eastern edge of Los Angeles County, but in Los Angeles County. And it's a freestanding cancer center. When I was there, it was in just the town of Duarte. Now it's expanded to be, I guess, nationwide with some of its acquisitions. But it's a freestanding cancer center, not for profit, and is a NCI-designated cancer center.
And what was it when you arrived and they go, okay, Dr. Rackham, you are now director of thoracic oncology. Who were you directing? Was there a program there or was it just you?
No, there were a group of three of us who were there. And it was it was a very nice mix of people, because I think, as you know, when you do a program that is focused on clinical research, you need clinicians that are, number one, seeing patients, because you can't put patients on trial without the patients. And you need people who are dedicated to the mission. And I think that at least the way that the program had been run at that time, I think some of the pressures of, increasing RVUs and things like that challenged people. But the way that it was run at that time, we had some really good, solid thoracic oncology clinicians who were dedicated to putting patients on trial, and maybe not writing their own trials, not at the cutting edge of doing the science, but really committed to being clinical investigators. And I think that model was very helpful to have people around who were that committed. And then I would say having City of Hope, because it is a research institution, and it doesn't take patients who don't have a diagnosis of cancer. So in order to come to City of Hope, you have to have some level of insurance coverage and you have to have a diagnosis of cancer. So when people got there, they were willing to they were already understanding that research was going to be a part of their care. And so I do believe that more patients stepped in the door ready to be on a clinical trial than you might see at another institution.
And how did you build the clinical research program there? I mean, how well established was it before you got there?
So I think that they were committed and they were doing a lot of industry trials. I think that when I got there, we started to do more investigator-initiated trials. We started to do more kind of novel agents and early phase trials. It was also kind of the advent of, genomic alterations. Being on the West Coast, we had these patients, and so we were able to be on many of the trials looking at, EGFR resistance, looking at ALK, looking at RET, looking at some of the alterations that might be more difficult to find in other areas. So I think we were well poised to kind of be in that moment, especially as genomic alterations became defined, and that was kind of how the clinical trials were run at that time.
What year did you start at City of Hope?
I was there starting in 2007.
Okay, so if I do my math right, how long were you there before you met your second husband?
So we actually met at UCLA before I left, probably about a year after fellowship.
Okay. And then he was working at, since he's going to become the person we're going to talk about as a caregiver, let's talk about Bob a little bit. So how did you first meet Bob?
So we were working at UCLA, so we had known each other for a long time. And then after I became a single person, then we pursued an interest that we both had and found each other, interested in each other. And the relationship moved on from there.
Did he stay at UCLA or did he move?
He actually had gone to City of Hope before that. So he went to City of Hope and was there, but he had a long career at UCLA doing mostly kidney cancer.
And he's an oncologist too.
He's a kid oncologist and that has done a lot in renal cell carcinoma.
So now you're and he's older than you.
He is.
By 15 years, is that what you told me?
About, yes.
Okay. And so is that, as we get older, the age gap doesn't matter as much, but at that point in time, how was the age gap? Was it, because you were at different stages of your careers at that point?
I mean, I think that I think that it wasn't a big problem. It was something that obviously I think the outside world sees more than the inside world, you know, and I think when you have mutual connections and you have things that bring you together, they're more personal, and what the outside world sees may be a lot of chatter compared to what the comfort and connectivity that you're feeling from your mutual connection. So I think we had a lot of commonalities that broke away from any age difference, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then your son was born what year?
He was born in 2008.
2008. Okay. So you've got this new job, get pregnant. And then how did you run with that?
So I think that I'm driven by the fact that I go back to where I was when I was in elementary school and seeing my aunt with ovarian cancer. I am first an oncologist. And so what I bring to my everyday life is that I'm an oncologist in this world. And I am my son's mother, I am my husband's wife, but I'm an oncologist in this world. And so that drives me in a way. And so I had my child, I reveled in the fact that there was new life around me because, you know, when we work in the world of oncology, it's often living at the edge of the end of life rather than the beginning of life. So I think it was a eye-opening experience, you know, to have a child and to be around young children and have that just sheer joy of life in my life in a way that I probably couldn't have even imagined before. And so it was wonderful to have a child and to raise him. But there's always been a part of me that I'm also an oncologist, and that part of me is not separable from, you know, my core. So it was not a stretch to go back to work, to go back to research, and to keep doing what I do. And I also feel, you know, as a mother, I have one son, I am his example in this world, and he needs to see what this kind of motivation and passion is in the world from his mother as much as from his father or other people.
Yeah, I think that's a great statement. I think in one of the other podcasts, I mentioned this this quote from a friend of mine who's a psychologist, that he gets frustrated when people say, you know, what's your greatest achievement? And people are supposed to say their children. But he goes, yeah, no, I'm very proud of my children, but I also did other things too.
Yes, I agree. I mean, my son is amazing and I'm very proud to be his mother, but I would not be the same mother if I wasn't the oncologist that I am.
How long did you spend at City of Hope? I mean, you spent a long time there. I got to know you.
I was there for 13 years. So, City of Hope kind of built me and grew me into a senior oncologist. So I got through my assistant and associate professor level days at City of Hope. And it really did help to grow me, being inside a NCI designated cancer center, becoming a leader within the clinical trials office and really learning the ropes and then continuing to have a research presence where I was doing clinical research. I was working with the labs doing translational research and really able to build my career and kind of a solid sense of who I was in the world of thoracic oncology and oncology in general.
Did you feel there was a kind of turning point when you went, I'd made it, people know who I am?
I don't know that. I don't know that you ever totally feel that. I think there was a moment when I was after I became a professor, and I was at ASCO, and I realized that I could say yes or no to meetings based on my interest, rather than needing to just kind of, you know, do the hustle and say yes to everybody and try to get every trial and try to get, you know, FaceTime with everybody. I learned that I was at an ASCO meeting and I was like, oh, this is my meeting now. Like,
yeah.
I actually have some say in where I go and how I manage my time, more so than I ever did in the past. And so I think that was probably a handful of years ago, is maybe just pre-COVID or just post-COVID, but a kind of a moment where I felt more in control of my career than chasing something. So I think that may be the closest to having that type of feeling.
There's also that realization when you say, okay, if I move institution, my reputation will actually go with me and won't just stay because it's associated with, you know, my past institution.
Yeah. So I think that when it was time to think about something new, it was interesting. It was in 2019 and I was looking to do more leadership and wanted to kind of grow. And I felt like where I was at a very stable, good level, but it seemed like I needed to move on to be able to grow in my career. And at that time, Cedars-Sinai was separating the hematology and oncology departments or divisions, and we're looking for division chairs for both of those divisions. And it seemed like a natural kind of move. It's also closer to my house. So as my son was going into middle school and high school, it seemed maybe helpful to live a little closer to home. I had been traveling 40 miles in each direction to go to City of Hope, which is not a small thing. Yeah. Now, pre-COVID, where there was not a lot of work from home types of days. So
40 miles in Colorado and 40 miles in Los Angeles.
It's a whole different thing. Yeah. It's about an hour in each direction without much traffic. So, but it's a commitment for sure.
So describe Cedars-Sinai. Sorry, I got to get my S's in the right place. So does Sinai.
So Cedars is now I've kind of been around all the institutions in the Los Angeles area. I guess next is USC. I haven't spent much time there, but Cedars-Sinai is a hospital system that also has an academic faculty, and the academic faculty is a newer entity. We actually are now called Cedars-Sinai Health Sciences University. This is a commitment to grow more academically, but really it was the community hospital in the area and then growing academic. So it has a interesting platform, is kind of what they call a pluralistic kind of society, because there are many community physicians who also admit patients, see patients within that community of what is Cedars-Sinai. And so there are faculty physicians, there are medical network physicians, and there are completely private physicians, all of which make up the milieu of the population of physicians and caregivers that are working as healthcare providers at Cedars-Sinai.
So of the patients on the ward, it's like some of them are yours and then some of them are somebody else's and you don't have to see them?
Correct. Correct. It's a whole, yeah. So it's not, you know, and again, to compare and contrast, you know, it's not like every patient that walks in with lung cancer, we aren't seeing every patient, which has good and bad to it, you know, especially as you're trying to develop a clinical research program. But it has been historically how Cedars has run. And it's really a hospital that the community sees as a place for them. So it's a really unique experience in that way, too, because we have the breadth of very excellent subspecialties across all subspecialties versus being at a City of Hope, which is a cancer center, and everybody's, you know, driving in the direction of cancer. Now we have people that find excellence across the board, and cancer is a part of that.
So does your academic program compete with these private practitioners? I mean, you're kind of rubbing shoulders with people who are trying to do the same sort of thing, aren't you?
Right. I mean, it's any big city, I think you see competition across the board. And so we're competing with other institutions, we're competing with other physicians, and there is a lot of competitive nature within that. Then there's also a lot of insurance nuances where a patient can go here, they can't go there. So there's a lot of nuances in a large urban population.
Did Bob move to Cedars too?
He had actually been at Cedars. He actually started his fellowship at Cedars, his residency at Cedars back when he moved to Los Angeles initially. And so he was, he's kind of come full circle, but he had been at Cedars for about a decade before I went there.
It's funny because I think from my perspective, I always think of you as leading this, but you know, you're kind of, I don't mean to be calling you the trailing spouse because you're sort of, you know, you have your own independence, but it's like Bob goes somewhere and then it's not like there's a refractory period of several years and he's like, oh, okay, I'll just kind of come and join you.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, the Cedars was about a decade, so it was a lot more than just a few years to join, and because it was more about the opportunity. For a long time, there weren't the right opportunities there for me, but it is certainly closer to where I live and kind of makes life, especially with a teenager, much easier to manage, and I am able to come home for evening dinners, which are, I think, becomes very important when your kid's in high school. That became a really helpful thing after I moved over to Cedars.
And Bob had a leadership position at Cedars as well?
He has been the deputy cancer center director at Cedars.
Okay. And I'm doing that because we're going to get into his part of the story fairly soon. I actually have got my one other fanboy thing about Cedars. So Cedars is like Hollywood's hospital, is that right?
Part of it is, yes. So I will have to say, we also see more uninsured patients than probably any other institution in Los Angeles. But we do all have our share of Hollywood types that come there too.
Do you have lots of things named after movie stars?
There is a Steven Spielberg building that we have some labs in for sure. So yes.
Somebody told me that the voice in the elevator is some movie star or something like that.
I don't know that their voice is in the elevator anymore, but there is a Barbara Streisand, I think for hearts, for cardiac, women's health, things like that. So there are definitely names that you would recognize all around. The main road where I park my car is George Burns Way. So,
all right, let's start to edge into the story of highly successful Dr. Reckamp, you know, mother of a teenage boy. You must have help at home with a teenage, well, actually he's a teenager who doesn't need it, but you must have had help at home with you and Bob, you know, being out of work and working all hours.
Yes. So I don't live near my family. And so we live far away. Bob is from Philadelphia and we don't have any family in the immediate vicinity. So we always had somebody who would help our team and help our son. And when he was really little, we had a full-time nanny and somebody who's been working with us for a long, long time. And so as he's gotten older, she's kind of helped to clean our house and help with things around the house, and has been part of our family. And if you ask her, she probably knows more that of the things that are going around our house and our neighborhood than I do. And she certainly makes sure everything is running. So Frida really runs the household and is really, if anybody ever says, you know, I need a mom, Frida serves as the mother that I need on a daily basis. And so she's really become somebody that she cares about us, we care about her. And so having her in our lives and the fact that my son needed her less was kind of interesting, that our lives kind of got completely turned over and we needed her in another way.
So Bob's had a brush with cancer before, though. We'll get to the most recent one in a second.
So he, a few years ago, had a nodule on his kidney and had a chromophobe early stage kidney cancer removed. And that, though, you know, disruptive, in having the scare of cancer was something that was manageable, was early stage, and just needed CT scan follow-up.
And he's a kidney cancer doctor. So was that kind of like, I totally get this, or did it freak him out?
I think on his level, a little bit of both, like, because he intellectually knows it, but the word cancer is scary no matter when you hear it. It jars you. And so, but I think it was something that we all felt like was very manageable and not at top of mind necessarily.
And how often was he getting CT surveillance?
I think it was on an annual basis.
Okay. And so in 2025, he got his annual CT and everything looked good?
So yeah, I think he does it kind of as the summer ends, and he had a CT scan. Everything looked good. All the labs were good. He was planning to get a kidney stone, extracted at the end of the year, and everything was fine.
And then what happened?
We decided to do something for ourselves and not go into the family milieu for Thanksgiving. And we decided to take a short trip to Mexico and just kind of hung out by the beach and relaxed over Thanksgiving. And Bob wasn't feeling spectacular, but in Mexico and not being able to eat so much, you figure you've eaten something and it's things have gone south a little bit. But he definitely, in retrospect, wasn't himself. When we got home, and a few days later, as the week started in the beginning of December, he turned a very obvious shade of yellow that is not normal in our world, and then had some lab tests for this plaid procedure that he was going to have for his kidney stone, and showed that he had a bilirubin of 8.
Who noticed the jaundice first, you or him?
I think we were both kind of noticing it, and probably also playing that denial game, like it can't be kind of thing, because it didn't seem real or correct. Because again, just a few months ago, there was a normal CT scan, there was a normal whole set of labs. So what could be happening just didn't seem real or rational at that time.
Okay, so he is the yellow. His blood tests show that he's jaundiced, that his bilirubin is up. Is Bob telling you what's going through his head? Are you having separate kind of thought processes? Are you discussing it?
So I think there's always separate things going through our heads. And I think we, as especially as people who know too much, there is a little bit of censoring because you don't want to say out loud the worst of what you're thinking. So I think there is definitely some of that censoring. I tend to be the glass half full person. And so my thought is, well, maybe it's just a gallstone. And I think he goes to the darker place of, this is going to be the end. This is the beginning of the end, kind of thing. But also going into the rational thought of, okay, what do I need? So I take care of patients all the time. And so when you have a bilirubin of 8, there are some logical things you need. My thought process is, if this was your patient, you'd put them in the hospital. but that wasn't something that that was going to happen. And so we managed by making some phone calls and obviously people were as alarmed as we were and got things running pretty quickly.
So this is early December or late December?
Beginning of December, right after Thanksgiving.
Okay. And what are you saying to your son at this point?
At this point, we're trying to just be factual, saying dad's going for some tests. This is what's happening. We don't know what's going on. But he is a child who has grown up and he's mature now. And he has grown up for 17 years with two oncologists who certainly take phone calls, certainly have conversations that are not your normal, dinner table conversations. And so he knows when things are not right. And he knows that things can go south from things that he's heard over the course of the last 17 years of his life. And so I think he's worried, but there just isn't enough information to give him more. And so we try to reassure him that as we get information, we will tell him, but we're all kind of in the same boat. And so we become, people in that early phase of getting a diagnosis where the unknown is so enormous and the fear of what could be is so large that you just have to live in that hugely anxious space for, you know, however long it takes. And it's a difficult place to be.
How long did it take?
So again, we have good connections. We've been in this business for a long time. And so within, by the end of the week, he was having the definitive procedure, and there was a concern that there was a mass by the pancreas. And then over the weekend, we got the preliminary diagnosis.
And do you remember, so who got the information first?
That came to Bob directly.
And then did he share that with you straight away?
I think that obviously we're all on edge. And so when the phone call comes on a Saturday, there's not much else that we're committed to. And so I think that he took a phone call outside, and then he put it on speaker, and we were all both of us were on the phone together to hear the information.
And what was the diagnosis?
So the diagnosis was a pancreatic adenocarcinoma.
So pancreatic cancer.
Correct.
When you heard those words, do you remember how you felt, how you thought?
I think the first place is to go to that business-like place of oncology-type place of what do we do? But I will say, we got the diagnosis on a Saturday, and as the weekend went on, that word pancreatic cancer, it sits with you, and it is a heavy, heavy word. And so then I think we both started reaching out in our own ways to bring in, you know, kind of some of the most important people just to say the word out loud, you know, to bring in some friends and some family to say the word out loud, to shed tears, and to make what didn't seem could be real into something that was real.
How did you deal with it? Did you have the conversations with Bob? Were the tears with Bob or the tears with friends?
A little bit with him, but a lot of it was with others. I think we were trying to stable ourselves in this versus hanging on to each other at that moment.
Yeah. And what was going through your head?
I think that during the next subsequent weeks, the thoughts were just varied between practicality: what do we need to do? How do we take care of our son? How do we make sure he's okay? And sheer panic.
Yeah.
And it was more helpful to take care of things. Okay, let's call the school. Okay, let's, you know, figure out how to get him to a friend's house. Those things were easier than to sit with the unsettling thoughts of what this all means to have a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer.
And when they first told you about it, did you know that it was potentially operable?
So those pieces of information were coming a little bit later. So obviously we just knew an answer, and again, I go to the glass half full, and I think this has got to be. You had a normal scan 2 months ago. Like, how could this be, right? And I think probably part of what we did was went back to the records and read through every word to see, did we miss something? What does it actually say? And reading all the reports to say, what am I missing? You know, and that's with my physician's hat on, is to say, can I see something else that will help me define, you know, if there's something more serious going on here.
So again, you know, you're, you know, for want of a better term, a power couple at Cedars-Sinai. You've got the deputy director of the cancer center, and you've got the head of thoracic oncology. In fact, the division head of medical oncology. I forgot that. So does that mean you're Bob's boss?
No, we have certain lines that don't cross. So he's got higher up reporting structure.
Got it. It's well known in this thing, in this healthcare network. You've got to figure out what happens, but how do you also tell those other people who look to Bob and look to you that when something's going on?
So I think he's been at Cedars for a long time and had really some close people that he's worked with. So a lot of it was having some of these phone calls and talking it through And I think that what became clear is that people fill in when there's blank space, people will fill it in. And he was going to be out or partially out for a period of time that was undefined. And so once that email came out that said, I'm not going to be around, people were going to fill in the blanks. And so it was kind of easier to just tell them what we knew and tell them what was going on. And so for the most part at work, the information started just to become known rather than trying to deal with. I mean, many people, when they are diagnosed, they have aliases and things like that so that it's not as immediately obvious. But he kind of just said, let people know this is what's happening. And then when I need people's support, then hopefully they'll be there. And so I think that that was the decision, was to put it out there and just let people know.
I think you told me that one of your colleagues who was a thoracic surgeon approached you because they saw his name on one of the operating lists.
So yeah, the day that he was having surgery, you know, the procedure that you have is a Whipple, and there's no other reason that you have a Whipple other than having pancreatic cancer to remove. And so his name was on the board with the name Whipple next to it and the specific surgeons who do Whipple surgeries and, you know, pancreatic cancer surgeries. And so one of my colleagues was in the OR and saw me in the waiting room and was very wonderful and consoling me and asking me how I was doing, checking in the back to get the real information about what was actually happening in the OR, but really was quite lovely. But obviously knew immediately what was happening and who it was happening to, just because of the name on the board and the procedure that was happening. So it shows you that the vulnerability, you know, I think as doctors, we don't like to understand our vulnerability. We like to put it on others. And that's, you know, half of our lives. We can make other people feel comfortable with their own vulnerability and can be in charge of that. And now we're in a place where we have to be the vulnerable parties. And that's a huge shift.
And how did you react? We talked a little bit about how you were dealing with stuff yourself, and then suddenly you've got other people's distress.
So I decided to continue to work. In part, I was actually the person covering the inpatient service, and so I was in the hospital covering. We were close to the holidays, and it seemed to make sense to continue to do that because I had to fill my days with something. And it's again much easier sometimes to take care of other people's issues and people who have real problems in the hospital than to wallow in your own problems day in and day out. And so I stayed in the hospital and I was working. But so I'm interacting with a lot of people, and all of a sudden you have people and they're looking at you and you're just going through your day, but then they're seeing you, they're having a reaction. They don't know what to say. There's this awkward exchange. And all of a sudden you're dealing with their emotions as much as you're dealing with your own emotions. And I think everybody has emotions when it comes to cancer. And so the minute they think of a diagnosis that you may have or that your loved one may have, it immediately has an impact on them because of experiences they've had. And so it's always tangled up into so much emotion that, often it becomes, I've kind of moved on from the immediate shock, and then you're comforting them from their immediate shock. And so you become a comforter of other people's emotions pretty quickly.
Did you find a coping mechanism? I found that the initial reaction was to be sort of dismissive. And I felt that was, looking back now, that was the wrong approach. You know, it's like, oh, no, it's no big deal, you know, but it's a big deal. No, it's like, but it's partly to sort of, you know, you're trying to get yourself ahead of that situation. Whereas now I just say, you know, I just appreciate people's concern.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that, and it partially because it's not me.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's even more different because often people are trying to confer what they want to say to my husband, to me, in a very awkward way. And so, and then you also have the issue of they want to know how they're doing.
Yeah.
And for much of these last months since the diagnosis. It's been just variations on not great, but some days are better than others, and the outlook is still very good. And so you choose different ways of saying either things are not great, or he's going to get through it and he'll be okay, or whatever you say. But there's, if they say, how's Bob doing today? I mean, the answer for the last number of months is kind of just not great. But that's not an answer that they know how to react to. And so then you get their reaction, oh, I'm sorry. And then there's a back and forth about it. And so sometimes it's just easier to say, oh, he's having a good day today.
Yeah.
And then that makes them feel okay about it. And then you don't have to console them for feeling bad about his bad day, right? And so there's a lot of, censoring of information to get through those conversations.
What date was the Whipple?
It was December 10th. And the day after my birthday.
Well, at least it wasn't on your birthday. So a Whipple is a big old replumbing. You're taking out the head of the pancreas, which is where, bile ducts and everything else go in, and parts of your gut are resected. So it's a big old deal. I don't want you just saying, he wasn't great, but I mean, what was it like in the first few weeks after the Whipple?
So yeah, it's one of the biggest surgeries that I think can be done for cancer. I think maybe things that we do to move vessels in the chest could be just as big, but it's really one of the biggest surgeries that can be done. And I have to say that for all of it, he has done incredibly well. He's, exceeded anybody's expectations for how well he's done. But that doesn't mean that it's not, just really, really difficult in those days afterwards. And so those first days in the hospital were no short of just torture in a way that you couldn't get your head around what it would be. I don't think there's anything that could prepare you for it. And so, you've got many, many tubes hanging out of you. Fortunately, they have really great ways of using the epidurals and helping with the pain. So I don't think that pain in itself was a big problem, which I feel grateful for. But you just have multiple tubes, multiple drains. You can't move on your own, and your biggest goal is, walking down the hall and back again, with somebody helping you with all the poles and all the and your gown flapping in the back. And it really.
Yes. Just to add insult to injury. Yeah.
Right. And I think that where he was so uncomfortable that it just those little things didn't matter, because I was like, oh, do you want to put some sweatpants on? Do you want to? And he's just like, no, like that's even harder than the rest of it. Even doing that act of trying to put a new piece of clothing on is just too difficult right now. And so he did it. And this is a person, who has had leadership roles, and he did it. Not always with grace. Sometimes more than others, sometimes not at all, with no grace at all, but he did it. And again, every day he had the successes that he was supposed to have, but literally it's like you walk down to the edge of the nursing station and people are clapping for that.
Yeah.
For people who are goal-oriented, as we have been for much of our lives, it seems very shallow. So important. So important.
And, or it's that same drive. You just,
right.
It's the kind of grit to get through these things.
Yes. Yes.
How long did you spend in the hospital?
A week.
Okay. Wow. I would have thought it would be longer. That's actually pretty impressive.
Yeah. So a week is a long time in the hospital these days, though. I have to, but you do, you have a lot of, there are for many people come and go during that week. But then there's that person down the hall who's been there that long and will be there longer. And you learn some of their stories, and we're all in this human condition together. And I think that is a huge reminder to go from physician to patient to caregiver, that this is a universal experience of being human, and being physicians doesn't protect us from that in any way.
When he comes home, I could imagine that as the caregiver, that's another level of stress, because you're removing all of that. Well, the hospital's looking after him. So what was it like him coming? Was he eating at that point, or has he still got a tube down up his nose and into his stomach?
No, he was actually able to eat some. It's slow going, and there are a lot of liquid and mush-filled meals in the beginning. But he was eating some. But I will say that, you know, since before the surgery, there hasn't been a normal meal in that he's had yet. So between the surgery and then the chemotherapy, there's not really normal eating happening for him. And so that's a huge challenge. I had friends dropping things off, you know, mush filled things that they learned about of post Whipple, what you needed to eat, and they brought things, and it was really great. But the day in and the day out it's more the he's a very independent person, and he's well enough to get himself around. He didn't need help moving and things like that, and getting out of bed or things like that. He was self sufficient, but just that purpose and that ability to do the things you want to do, your expectations have to go much, much lower. And so living in that space of where those expectations are, and especially as the healthy person, I can still do these things that I enjoy doing, and he absolutely cannot do 90% of those things. And so that's a real challenge that just needs lots of work to keep working through.
How much weight has he lost?
Probably about 25 pounds, which is now kind of stabilized.
And I think you said he's still not eating quote unquote normally.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, well, after the surgery, things got better and he was on solid food and everything, but then starting chemotherapy, which is FOLFIRINOX. And so it's basically everything and the kitchen sink, the way that I think about it. So every good drug we have for GI tumors is given all at the same time. And so so it's rough on the system, and it's an every 2 week regimen. And so you have about 7 to 10 challenging days and about 3 better days. And then you start again. And so it's a challenging regimen.
So you said earlier the importance of having evening meals together with your teenage son. So do you still eat together, even if you're eating different things?
So we do, and we have meals that are usually shortened when, he eats what he can. This is right now we're in a, he just had chemo last week and finished on Sunday. And so these are the harder days. And so usually it's a shortened meal where he doesn't stay at the table all that long, but he eats part of the meal with us and then we finish. And so there's always that presence of eating as something that is not normal. It just always kind of lives in our presence, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And how is he doing?
So I will say that, he has decided that he wanted to be part-time and has done a lot of the administrative work, which has been helpful for him and for, I think, the Cancer Center. He tries to keep his mind sharp and doing things. And but there are moments of quiet where I still think you can go to the dark places, which is sometimes what he kind of needs to do for himself to kind of flush it out, I think. But he doesn't always want to share that. That's something that he kind of ruminates in his private space with. And I think he really does want to have some normal time with myself and with Zach. And so I think he does one thing that he comes to together with Zach on our playing or watching sports. And so now, you know, watching the basketball playoffs and things like that are helpful for them, that they can come together and do something that feels normal but doesn't take a whole lot of, you know, extra energy to do it. And so I think trying to spend time as a family and be present is probably the most important thing. But things that need a lot of energy expenditure are not things that are going to happen at this time.
I think one of your really interesting observations is our need to have different people for different kinds of conversations. And I think you said Bob's son from his prior marriage is someone he sort of goes dark with. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I think that we, you can't just say what's on your mind all the time to everybody around you, or it's just, I think it's too much of a burden. And I do think that, again, I tend to be the person that tries to be positive, tries to see the bright side, and tries to kind of help get through the day to say, but you're doing well, and this is how well you're doing, and we know this is going to be a hard day, but in a week it's going to feel better, and we're getting through this. And, you know, I'm kind of that cheerleader voice. And that's what I need to be. And I think I need to be that for our son, for my husband, and to keep every day moving in the forward direction. But there are those lows, and he tends to not come to me with those deep, dark thoughts. But he has an older son who is an adult with his own children. And I think that's a place where he goes with his older son. And he has thoughts about, you know, what if I'm not here? What if the worst things happen? And those are places that he can go with him. And I think a little bit with his own brother, but less so with myself and our son here. And so I think he somewhat picks and chooses where he goes with that information. But I think it's natural to share differently with different people and kind of try it out. Like, you know, where can I go with this person? What level can they take with me? And where can I be safe to say some of the things that are on my mind, but not, you know, dive down there and never come back up? Because that's a dangerous thing, too.
What about you? I mean, yes, you have to be the cheerleader, but presumably there are times when you don't want to be the cheerleader.
So I think that I do think as a caregiver, especially in this, so we're in a scenario where he's had surgery, and then this is an adjuvant treatment, and so it is self-limited. So I do think that I have somewhat the ability to say I can be in this space knowing it's not forever. And so, like, give myself the 6 months to be more of that person. But yeah, we all need to have outlets to say kind of the scary things on our mind, to say the crazy things on our mind. And I think it is hard when your partner is going through it. It is hard to put it on them. Like, because my worst day is never as bad as his good day.
Yeah.
And so, like, how am I gonna complain about something that happened? Not that I don't, but it's much less often than I would have in the past. And so how do I let all that out? And so I think it's having friends and colleagues that will listen, and they're taking probably the brunt of more of it, because it can't sit. There's not as much space for that stuff to sit in our relationship right now.
And given, okay, the goal of the surgery, the goal of the adjuvant chemotherapy is to cure Bob, but it's not a guarantee. And how do you deal with that? Or are you just in the kind of, I can only see the cure, and, you know, that's eyes on the prize?
So I think I live with my eyes on the prize, with short moments in the reality of what we all know is the uncertainty and the mystery that lives in a diagnosis of cancer. And I feel like I have spent the better part of 20 plus years helping people in that space of the unknown. And so I guess maybe I think I have a little bit more ability to kind of explore that space, even with just within myself, if you will, because I feel like I know it. And maybe these 20 plus years have kind of prepared me to live in this space because I've given a lot of advice out to other people about it. And so I think I have some, and I, this is really something I've not thought about. This is something you're making me think about right now, is that I think I have some space inside of me to cultivate that uncertainty and live with it, at least right now.
Yeah, I think oncologists can live in the gray zone more comfortably than others can. You know, it's either black or white.
Right.
So how is Zach dealing with it?
I think he's very resilient, and he has a very good group of friends, which I think is, I feel grateful for. And he's been able to tell some of his friends just so that they know where he's at some of the time. But he said to me at one point when we had some time, just him and I together, he said, "I think that you're not telling me something," which I take it as that he feels that uncertainty that we live in.
Yeah.
So I tried to explain to him that there is this unknown world that, you know, it's this unknown that none of us know. And it may feel like we're not telling him, but it's really because we don't know right now. Versus telling him it'll all be okay. And I feel like he's seen enough in his lifetime of how we've talked to patients and things like that when he's been in the room, that anything other than that kind of honesty is probably not helpful to him.
Yeah.
So, but it's hard to, I don't want to put more on him than he's ready for, but yet here we are.
And then the obvious question is, how has this affected your own practice as an oncologist? If it has.
I think there's probably two things. There are some days that I may be more raw than I was before. And so some days are just harder. Yeah. And to take some of the hard things that happen within our clinic, it takes a little more time to recover from, because the depth of how hard that is, because I think maybe I'm just more human in that in experience, because I know how real it is, and I'm a little more attached to the outcomes and how it feels as a human. And so that rawness is sometimes makes a clinic day a little more, I kind of need a buffer zone around it to recover from it, versus, going out with friends on a after clinic or something. I probably couldn't do that right now very well. But I think I'm also more aware, I'm more aware of people's chemotoxicities, much more aware, and understanding how even mild, what we would consider, you know, grade one nausea can have a huge effect on the day in and day out life of a person. Yeah. And not minimizing. So often you say, oh, you had a little nausea following chemo. Oh, you're doing great, which is all true. But then understanding that that is still a distressing time and probably some very difficult days that the person is having to go through.
You mentioned to me that you noticed the caregiver a little bit more too.
So also I would say that I have more of affinity toward the people who are those caregivers in the patient's lives. So, you know, it's been really the focus is on the patient, what the patient needs as it needs to be. But I have an acute understanding of what it is to be that person next to the person and listening to the information. And you're always navigating, I don't want to speak for you, but I want to share my impression of how this, you know, last cycle has gone. And so trying to find that space and understanding that sheer magnitude of that diagnosis from a caregiver perspective, when somebody gets first diagnosed and the patient is there and has a million questions and you're standing there on the side, your life has been upended and you're still secondary, but I can see that person in a way, and like I know like how that feels, how your life just feels like it's crashing in on you. And all you need to do, you really want to be there for that for your loved one also, but that crashing in feeling is very real for the caregiver too. And so I think I have an acute awareness of what they're going through and what they're experiencing.
So now, Karen, we have to figure out how we're going to wrap this up. You got any bright ideas? Because it's all still ongoing.
Right, right. So yeah, so like right now it feels just really raw. I don't know if you have words of wisdom because you've been living in this space a lot longer. This is off the cuff. I'm just like, what is your, as you're listening to this, is it, what is your kind of take on this conversation so far?
No, I mean, it's insightful. I'm giving a talk at the Hope Summit in a week or so's time. And one of the things I point out is, it's easy for people to see the burden in the cancer patient. They can see it. They can see, they can see the side effects. They can see the diagnosis of the word cancer, but nobody can see the caregiver sort of bent double under a more invisible load.
Right. I think that's poignant. I think that, you know, and as a caregiver, your problems will never be big enough. And so where do you go with all of that? I don't have the insight yet. I guess I haven't been through far enough to know a better insightful answer. But I have to, I will say that what is clear is that you cannot go into the relationship with all of those issues. And so I will just say, you know, we talked about my son's nanny who's helping with Robert. And I will say she's probably single-handedly saving my marriage.
Yeah.
Because she's doing, so she's there during the day. She helps him figure out lunch. And again, meals are such a challenge. So she's there to take over, to help in that way. I can go to work. I can do my life. I can live my and be my independent self. I can push off against other people. I can have other issues. I can complain about what's going on at home if I need to, and I can come back and then I can be the person I need to be. Because for now, I cannot get that same support inside this relationship in that way. But utilizing the people around you helps to keep things moving forward and helps that support to continue. And just as he can go to that dark place with his son, he doesn't need to go there with me. And that helps us keep moving forward. If we lived in this terrible dark place all the time together, I don't think we could parent. We couldn't, you know, get through some of these things. And so having that web of people in your life who can hold little pieces of this experience with you, I think is part of the way forward.
That is probably a great point to end on. I know this is still raw. I know it's still going on, but thank you for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the discussion.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @drcamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.